Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. I'm Brian Dunn.
I'm Robert Hookman Jr.
And we are here to talk about the success that was Spillers number 4, which just wrapped mere hours ago now, Robert.
It did indeed. And fortunately, Matt Bell has stayed late into the night.
Thank God for Matt Bell staying late.
Yeah, I feel so bad for the people who podcast last. I mean, they read last. So I understand the logic is that, you know, the same amount of time passes between the time.
Right.
That's what we're thinking when we schedule this. I don't know. Are you a fan of that line of thinking, Matt?
Sure. Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, you have me captive now, bound to the chair. I feel like I should agree.
I think maybe in the interest of logistics, though, we should, in the future, we should stop scheduling the person who lives furthest away.
We may have to take that into account. That may dictate from now on. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, and so Matt, he read his short story. Could you tell us how you pronounce the title of your short story?
Sure, it's Her Aeneid.
Her Aeneid.
Aeneid, yeah.
Aeneid, okay. Yeah. He read a short story, Her Aeneid.
And you're confident about this.
Yeah. Wow, confident enough.
Yeah. Well, that's what he said on stage reading. So yeah. I say whatever you say goes.
We tried to come up with pronunciations and just stumbled.
We tried all sorts of Aeneid, Aeneid. We went that route, but not in... Say it again?
I say Aeneid.
Her Aeneid.
But yeah.
All right, perfect. And for those people who were not fortunate enough to be at Spillers number 4 and hear the story read live by Mr. Bell, go ahead and please check out episode 30 of the podcast because we recorded it, and that's the episode that you can listen to it on. So thanks very much for being a guest on the podcast,
Matt.
Oh,
thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. All right, so... Wow, you're kind of a big deal here. Oh. I mean, you've got novels and short story collections, and so you have the short story collection that's coming out soon, and you brought it up. You said it was the first copy that you had read from, right, that you had used?
Absolutely. I was in New York last week doing some events and stopped by my publisher, Soho Press, had lunch with my editor, and got the first advanced copy of the book I've seen. So it's called A Tree or a Person or a Wall.
Yeah.
It's about 10 years of short stories.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was exciting. It was good to get to read from the book for the first time.
Yeah.
So thank you
very
so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So something I have to talk about real fast is...
Yeah.
Yeah, so you and I, we've been published in the same place because I saw that you have pieces up on McSweeney's Internet Tendency, right?
Yeah,
that's fantastic.
Yeah, I like the Internet Tendency a lot. I had a piece there a long time ago that was about hair boxes.
Yeah, it was like creative writing prompts.
Right,
starting
with
hair boxes.
Right.
Right,
so like a weird thing about people like dating through sending each other boxes of burnt hair.
Right,
as you do. I mean, in the pre-Tinder era, it was very confusing for everybody.
Pre-Tinder era,
how you met people. So
right.
We just sent each other hair, and they had a piece a couple years ago that was a
Samuel Beckett quotes.
Yeah,
your grading scale
according to Samuel Beckett.
Yeah, which got like a huge number of likes. It got like 32,000 likes.
Oh, that's crazy! I had no idea.
Oh, you had
many.
No idea?
No,
yeah.
That's great.
So my stuff there has gotten, I don't know, a couple thousand likes.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, but like 32,000, holy cow.
It's funny because it doesn't show up at the beginning of the semester, but the end of the semester, people start sharing it.
Do they start
semester.
Sharing
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I think
that's
people
so
are just
great.
Like grading fatigue. But I think I wrote it at the beginning, sort of, you know, you're trying to write like a grading scale for creative writing, which is always a little like, yeah, you know, it's a funny kind of thing to try to pin down. And when I had to pin it down, I thought it'd be funny to do this to someone who would have no truck with teaching creative writing. Samuel Beckett.
Like Samuel Beckett. I just think it's smart of you to write something that's gonna always come back around.
Yeah.
Hence the 32,000.
I would like
likes.
To think I did it because I was smart. That would be good. Yeah.
We're gonna go with that.
Yeah, it's a nice theory.
There's an interesting quote here that Brian came up with that a reviewer wrote about you that says that Matt Bell has built a national reputation on his own terms, completely outside the support system of New York publishing. That's one hell of a quote.
It's nice, yeah.
Tell us how that works.
Yeah,
well,
please do.
Tell us about the support system and how
Well, I mean, in some ways it's not... It's an old quote, so it's less true because my publisher's based in New York, who's published my... last two books and the next book. And certainly there's been a lot of New York support that didn't used to exist. But I think, you know, my first two books were published by very small presses. They were both essentially like a person, you know. The first book, How They Were Found, was published by Keyhole Press in Nashville, which was a guy, Peter Cole. The second book, Cactus and Baby, is published by a press called Mud Luscious Press in Fort Collins, Colorado. It's a guy, Jay Tyler. And I started, my first stories got published when I was living in a basement in rural Michigan, you know, in a, near a town called Hemlock, which is about 2 hours north of Detroit. And so, in some ways, I got lucky. My start happened, yeah, very far from any sort of recognizable publishing industry. But it was the early days of the internet community, and I think the internet in some early communities like Zoetrope, which was Francis Ford Coppola, has this. It's still there, I think, and it's still vibrant in certain ways. But this online writing workshop sort of community that he'd started that was free in the late 90s, early 2000s, where I met a lot of other writers. And so my first, I was a college dropout. I was writing stories and reading contemporary literary fiction for the first time. And the people I found to talk about with and work with, I found online. I found in weird places. It wasn't that I was in a college or a university or these things that I value very highly, but that just wasn't where I started.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And so I got lucky. I think I lived in the Midwest for the first 34 years of my life. I'm 35 now, I'll be 36, the end of this year. I got really lucky. I met a lot of the people I needed to meet in the Midwest or online, and also had a very Midwestern sort of blue-collar kind of work ethic about being a writer. Just something you showed up at, something you did every day, something you tried hard at.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's what that Kyle Miner, who said that, I think that's what he meant by that, although it's probably less true now.
Less true
than
now.
It was in the past. Yeah, but it's great. It's nice to have both those things. It's nice to have all, as much as you can, obviously.
Yeah.
In some ways, I kind of feel like this is what Spillers is trying to do. Like,
yeah.
We're trying to build a platform and a community in Phoenix that has absolutely nothing to do with any literary community anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think we're doing a halfway decent job of demonstrating that there's something sustainable here. Like, a lot of writers in Phoenix and in the connected cities are connected to each other.
Right.
And every time we do one of these events, it seems to just get more and more connected. I loved, like, in our audience tonight, there were a bunch of previous Spillers in our audience.
That's
tonight.
So great
did you
to
notice
see.
That?
We love seeing that. I did, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So hopefully maybe we're helping to build our own national reputation for the Phoenix literary community. I really hope.
The last place one of the places I lived in Michigan was in Ann Arbor, where the University of Michigan is. Of course, that has an incredible MFA program, incredibly strong.
They're one of the highest ranked.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Right? And an incredible community built around the university. And there were all these other literary communities in town that weren't interfacing with it, you know, people running cool magazines that are independent or cool presses, and sometimes there'd be connections, but real person to person. It's like you and I maybe were interacting, but like the institutions were not interacting with the independent stuff. And I think, you know, I'm new to Phoenix, so this is my end of my second year here, and one of the things that I worked at building, I think, in Ann Arbor, and that I'd like to work at building here, is that people like myself that are here because of ASU, I don't want that to be an insular thing. I don't want the community-based stuff to be insular. And I think it's exciting for things like Spillers that are bringing together people who are in the community, and people like Ford Chambers and people coming from ASU and people from other things. Like, we're all in the same room. We're all building things together. We said this before the reading tonight, but like, if we're all going to live here the rest of our lives, we're all going to care about literature, we're all going to care about books, and we're going to care about readings. Like, we should all build something together. Like, the idea that these things should be separate makes no sense to me. And I think it happens accidentally, mostly.
Yeah, but yeah, I can see
we
that.
We should be vigilant against it.
Right.
Right.
Well, so far, fortunately, we keep pulling people out of ASU to come.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. No. Huge, huge thing you guys are doing. Yeah. Absolutely.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, yeah. And so we had Leah Newsom.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And so when we were talking to her on the podcast, she said that you had tasked her with doing something that was like a literary community outreach type thing. Yeah. And so Spilled Milk.
Right.
Resulted from that. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So you're obviously a big believer in. In doing that and
literary citizenship. Yeah,
literary citizenship. Yep. There you go. Yeah, I liked that. Yeah,
that's a nice term.
It is. Yeah,
it is, isn't it?
So you are a professor at ASU
mm-hmm.
in the creative writing program, and Michael Holliday had to defend his thesis
with me and Tara. Yeah,
with you and Tara Eisen. Yeah. So this is like a ASU roundup we're having here tonight.
Right.
It sort of is. Yes.
With Spillers. Talk about that experience a little bit. Like, what is that process like for you, going through someone's thesis defense and then being able to watch a writer come out of that that you would then recommend for?
Well, obviously, Michael's an incredible writer, you know, and he was a year into the program when I started here, and I think I had him in about half the class I taught. Half the semester I taught was here. He was in my classes. But he's great. He's really dedicated and fantastic. And I'll say the same thing here I said at his defense, which was he gave an incredible reading of a different story from his thesis in his defense. And he, during the defense part, the Q&A part, people were asking, you know, the committee, me and Tara and another faculty member, and then were asking him questions, and then people from the audience. His answers were amazing. He's sure of what he's doing. He understands what he's doing. He's ambitious toward the future. And, you know, I've seen a lot of grad students give those talks. I've seen a lot of people who are applying to be professors give those kind of talks. You know, you give a reading and you give a job talk and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said in his defense, and I believe it now, if his defense had been a job talk, I would have wanted to hire him. I mean, it was just like an amazing,
wow.
He's a person who we're excited to get to see. You got to see him read tonight before he has a book. He's going to have a book. You got to see him. I've seen him talk about his ideas about writing before he's a professor of writing. And I believe if that's something he wants, it's something he'll have. It's exciting to be around. I think one of the interesting things about grad school is maybe opposed to maybe what undergrad is doing, although ideally it would do this, but I think maybe that's not always the case, is I think a good grad program produces people who are peers, you know? People come in as students, and even that sort of, I mean, I think it's closer to peers already. You bring in grad students that you respect as writers, you respect as thinkers, you respect as academics, even though maybe they haven't been in that role yet. But the idea is when they graduate, they have the same degree I have. They have the same thing I have.
Yeah.
They're writers. I'm a writer. We both have MFAs. Like, Michael was my student recently, but I think of him as a peer of mine. I was really pleasurable to read with a peer that I respect so highly tonight. And so I was really grateful for that.
See, that's so great that's the way you feel about it.
Yeah.
And that's a really nice way to think of it, you know?
Yeah.
At the end of it, you're peers.
And we love that you recommended him.
Oh, he's fantastic, right?
Thanks for that, by the way.
I'm so glad.
It was just an automatic win.
Yeah.
I was like, who would you recommend? And you said, Michael Holliday. And I went and read his stuff, and I'm like, okay, that was easy.
Right. Yeah, it's good. I like that.
It's nice
when other people see the same thing I see, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's an extraordinary writer, extraordinary person. I was really pleasure to share the stage with him.
Well, and he was very complimentary to you, too.
Oh,
we should just point that out before we go any further.
That's true.
Okay. I bribed him. I'm saying this generally. Yeah.
I don't believe it.
So a lot of times in these podcast episodes, I'm interested in kind of finding some sort of insight that a writer's got that other writers could maybe learn from or just at least mull over. And we've got a note here that you talk about how you write in the morning and that you look over your current manuscript before you go to sleep at night so that you start and end your day with the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Like, how does that help you?
Sure. So one of the things, I've always been a person who reads at night to go to bed, and my wife is a person, Jessica, who would prefer to be like in like a like an isolation chamber with no sound and no light and no right.
Okay.
And so there was always sort of a...
So in another house.
Yeah, yeah, right. Someplace where I was not.
Domestic bliss right
that's
there.
Right. The two-house marriage, you know? But no, she's great. And so she... So one of the things that happened when, like, tablets came out and e-readers and things like that was that I could read in bed without having, like, a bunch of lights on and stuff.
Yeah.
So that was great. And so I started reading on my iPad and... At some point, I realized I could send the document I was working on to my iPad, and I could read it on that. And so I started sending every day. When I finished writing in the morning, I'd write from ideally when I get up until about lunch. So, you know, and it's muddied by other things. But 3 or 4 hours in the morning, if things are going well. And then I just send it to my iPad. And then at night, it's there. And I lay down in bed and... And I'll read for a while, and I'll look at the manuscript on my tablet. And what I'm looking for now is I read until I see something that I could make better or I could fix. One thing. As soon as I see it, I stop.
Oh,
so
wow.
I see, sometimes it's like a sentence, like that's a comma's wrong place, so that word would be better if it was this word. Sometimes it's like a big thing, like, oh, that's the scene I need to write. But as soon as I know that, I just sort of fix it in my head, and I go to bed. And so I get up in the morning, and I go to the desk, and I have a task when I sit down. And all that does is it means that you don't sit down every day being like, how do I get back into this?
Yeah.
Like, you know.
You
right?
do.
You have this thing to do.
You got it set up already.
Yeah. And even if it's as dumb as, like, I literally need to move a comma.
Do you write it down?
Cool. The thing? No, no, no. No? Just hold it in your head. Yeah.
Jesus, I would never get to sleep.
Right, right.
Well, that would be the end. I would never
sleep
again.
You have to
again.
Get up and do it. But like the important thing is to not get up and do it. But the trick is like it's this promise to yourself, like tomorrow when you sit down, it will not be difficult.
Yeah.
Because wasn't this thing to do.
There was some famous writer.
Well,
it could
yeah.
have been like Hemingway, maybe.
Hemingway
say,
the
was
quit,
it Hemingway?
Quit while you're ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. Well, and he says, like, you know, once you're going good, that's when you stop. So
right.
the next day you can just jump right back
no,
into it.
If you
it.
Quit when you're frustrated,
yeah,
you're afraid when you sit down.
Or done.
Yeah.
If you
right.
quit when you're done,
right.
then the next day it takes a while. So
yeah.
you don't check email, you don't do anything like that until you've...
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think phones have probably destroyed that, right? Because our email, like, wakes up with us. But so one of the things that I do is I used to keep this just in a notebook, but now I keep it on... my website is sort of Tumblr-based, and I post it to Facebook. And I think you've both probably seen this, but I... one of the ways I settle into the desk is I'll read a craft essay or an interview with a writer I've been thinking about mm-hmm. or curious about. And as soon as I read something, I'm like, oh, that's a really good idea. That's something I think about. It's something I haven't thought about before or may want to mull over more. I write in a notebook I keep, and then I post it to my Facebook and to Tumblr, and then I go write. So it's like one of the ways I settle into the desk is this, like, I'll read somebody else talking about writing or thinking about writing, and it seems like I learn something. I switch over to writing. And it's just a thing to do while you have your first cup of coffee. Or like, but it's a task that's not about, is the thing I'm working on good? Which is like
okay.
a scary thing to settle into.
That's
right?
a big
right. It's a big
question
thing.
To ask yourself and that can get you stuck. Yeah.
Right. But if I pull up like an interview you gave, and I'm like, "What's Brian got that smart?" It's like
oh,
it's
wow.
nice. It externalizes it, right? So, but no, you know, you can pull up the if you don't know where to look, you pull up I pulled the Paris Review interviews, and like they're all great. And
they
so
are
you
great.
Just
yeah.
Scan one until like, oh, that's a really smart idea, and then I post it and I go into my work. With this smart idea in my head, instead of hoping that I'll have a smart idea today, which is maybe doubtful. So it's good. So like, these are all just like tactics to get you to the desk, right? It's
yeah.
Like,
but
I
these
have
are
a
lot.
To do.
I would say, but these are a lot better than the old adage of like stop writing in the middle of a sentence.
Sure.
So you know, I mean, these are like good creative things that
yeah.
you're talking about.
Yeah.
I like them.
Well, I think they're all feeding different things. Like one of the things you find out when you start teaching full time is like. you need to know a lot more than you know, you know?
Okay.
When I was teaching creative writing as a grad student, you're teaching like your first creative writing classes, like you're never going to see these students again. So you just tell them what you know, and in 15 weeks you do pretty well. And then you start teaching full time at a university, and it's like, cool, having your 200 level class and your 300 level class and your 400 level class. And it's like, oh, you're going to be around for like years. Do I have years worth of knowledge? Oh, you have to start reading else. You got to read some other stuff. You got to learn some more things.
There you go.
Pushes you.
Nice. It's a
reason to learn more. Yeah.
I actually especially appreciate that you take those great quotes that you start your day with and post them to Facebook, because being connected to you on Facebook, I get to start out.
Yeah, sure.
And I don't have to do any work at all. I just have to read your post.
Well, one of the great things about sharing that stuff as opposed to just keeping it for yourself, I think, and this is always a big thing for me, is to give away as much as you can, to disperse as much as you can. You and I don't always agree with something that I post, right? But the discussion around that, I end up learning more. Where if I just put it in my notebook and kept it myself, it would be really insular. And sometimes people point towards something else. They're like, oh, that reminds me of this, and then it teaches me something. Or sometimes people push back really usefully, and they're like, well, maybe, but also this. And I'm like, yeah, right. Like, it's more complicated than that. And so the sharing is like a gift, but it's also one that comes right back to you immediately.
Nice.
Because you share, I think there's, I don't know. Like, I feel like if there's somebody who, a book that's taught me something, or recently a novel, I'm like, oh, I want to do that. That there's a tendency to want to be like, I'll never show it to anybody, so people won't know when I steal that.
Writers can be very secretive about ideas.
I think about this a lot. The people that share information, ideas and insights and and whatever, they it seems to do nothing but build their lives.
Yeah.
The people who hoard stuff just end up kind of isolated and alone, and it doesn't
really
help anyone.
In a Tolkien novel. Eventually, hobbits murder you.
It's always so strange to me when people are skeptical of giving ideas away when they just immediately come back to you tenfold.
Right.
It's such a great thing.
I think so.
Well, I think that we have learned quite a bit here tonight with Matt Bell. I like these insights.
Oh, I appreciate it.
I really do. So, Matt, before we let you go, we have to ask the question of the evening to you. Robert, I'm going to let you do the honors.
You've kind of hinted at this through your Facebook post, so I don't think you're trying to keep it a secret or anything, but it surprised the hell out of me when I found out that you wrote a D&D novel.
Oh yeah.
Is this Baldur's Gate?
How
2?
What?
No. So
I'm not familiar with this whole
books about Dungeons & Dragons in different ways. Okay. So I wrote a book that came out this last year called Baldur's Gate 2, which is a part of a series that Boss Fight Books started a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the 33 and a third series for music.
Okay.
So they're individual volumes about individual classic video games. And so I wrote one about Baldur's Gate 2, which is this, came out in year 2000. It's this landmark Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game that's super influential. And so I sort of wrote about that, and also about growing up as a fantasy sci-fi reader mostly, mm-hmm. and playing Dungeons & Dragons and different things. And then a couple years ago, when I was coming out of grad school, I wrote a Dungeons & Dragons novel under a pen name with a friend.
So
I wrote it with a friend named Matthew Simmons, so we're both Matts. And we wrote it under the pen name Matthew Beard, because we're both Matts with beards.
Matts with beards.
There you go. And it's called The Last Garrison. So it was a fourth edition Dungeons & Dragons novel, which is kind of a Dungeons & Dragons retelling of Kurosawa's The Seven Samurai.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Which is
good,
because Star Wars is like a science fiction retelling.
So much stuff is based off of that.
Seems you can do that. But it was great. It was kind of like a weird project, but it was... So in some ways, that's actually my first published novel, was that novel.
Oh, okay.
Because it predates In the House. And I used the money that I made from it to take a class with Gordon Lish at the Center for Fiction in New York while I was writing In the House, while I was writing that book, while I was editing my first novel as an editor at a literary press. It was a weird time.
Wait, so are you saying that you can trace your success as a writer and novelist back to this Well, Dungeons and Dragons. But oh, could you please say that?
I'm the only person who's ever used their advance from a Dungeons and Dragons novel to take a class with Gordon Lish. And yeah,
that does good. Seem likely.
It does seem almost
yeah.
certain,
I think
right?
you're safe
almost
in saying
you were the first certain. And only human only, to have done that.
Only yes. Which some of the stuff in the Baldur's Gate book is about that time. So I talk a little bit about part of that book is about writing the Dungeons & Dragons novel, and about that class with Lish and about the weirdness of writing a D&D book while taking a class with a person who would have hated
would
that I did
not
that.
Have approved.
No, definitely not.
It was
absolutely
just such
not.
An interesting like fact to come across. And I thought, oh, and I immediately texted Brian. I'm like, I was like, look at what I just found.
He
and
did.
I
said, he was so excited.
This is what Matt means in his bio when he says, and other books.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
I just thought, what a wonderful way to gloss over such an,
yeah, well,
an
it's
interesting
a funny
history.
Thing, right? Where like Scrapper is like my second novel. But it's my third novel, right? So
right.
some of that stuff is. But I mean, Last Years is Matthew Beard's first novel. I don't want to steal it from him, so it's fine.
Yeah.
One of our favorite things, this would be maybe a nice place to wrap up, but one of my favorite things about that book is I think both Matthew and I tried to sneak different things into the book that maybe didn't fit. And like, I wrote what got cut from the book, a really Cormac McCarthy-esque Fall of the Elves. I wrote like a
Oh, Blood did you Meridian really? A Blood Meridian. Oh, that is a book.
Yeah, right?
Wow.
And, but there is in the book still like a Samuel Beckett-inspired passage that's using this like heavy Beckettian kind of repetition. And we wrote in things like that in part of the book. But a lot of that got cut out. But then in the Matthew Beard's this made-up person. He has a made-up bio. He has made-up Twitter and Tumblr, and he has all these things.
Oh, interesting.
But he dedicated the book to his wife, Jessica, and his girlfriend, Abby.
Ouch.
Which was a nice nod to our real partners, you know. So I feel like that's like the best little, the truth nugget in that book is the very first page of the book, of course, is this nod to his dual nature.
The D&D novelist who's getting all the action.
All the action. Absolutely.
There you go. Yeah.
Jessica and Abby. Well loved by Matthew Beard.
Well done, Beardy.
Yes. Good man.
Absolutely. I think that's fantastic. All right. Well, we really appreciate you coming out
Thanks
to Spillers
so much,
number
guys.
Four and being a guest on the podcast. Thank you so much, Matt
Absolutely.
Bell.
All Thank right. you.
Thank Thanks. You.
Appreciate it, gentlemen.